Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Meta Ideological Politics podcast. Today, we're joined by John Bunzel and Jackie Scarsello, representing the Simultaneous Policy Campaign, known more catchily as SIMPL. SIMPL is an idea, a framework, and an active campaign focused on international cooperation and the dangers of the lack thereof. SIMPL focuses on the structure of the international arena rather than the changing perspectives of particular actors. It highlights complexity, incentive structures, and game theoretic dynamics, asking how it is that our current setup disincentivizes nations getting along, when on many issues, getting along would seem to be in everyone's interest. Most importantly, SIMPL looks at the central issue of the first mover problem and the neglected factor of timing. With Nick DeFell, John wrote the book, The SIMPL Solution, on all of this and is leading the international effort to get SIMPL enacted around the world. Jackie serves as SIMPL's national coordinator in the United States, and we hope she'll be able to bring some practical on-the-ground insights in line with MIP's action-oriented ethos. We're excited to dig into this, especially during this decisive time when Russian forces are invading Ukraine in an unprecedented assault on the post-Cold War order. International coalitions are rallying, and matters of international organization are on everyone's mind. John and Jackie, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, thank you very much.
Really, really pleased to be here.
I thought we could start with just, what is your elevator pitch that you elevator give people? Pitch.
Okay. Well, basically, we have to start with the problem, and we'll come to the Russia-Ukraine thing later on. But in principle, if we're looking at global problems like climate change, like the proper regulation of financial markets, like fair and taxes for corporations, when we're looking at dealing with pandemics and overcoming vaccine nationalism, and you know, all these competition problems, they all suffer from the same dynamic, which is anyone that makes a first move in any decisive way, any nation that acts first, will suffer a competitive disadvantage, mainly economically, but it could also be militarily. So SIMPL is really a citizens' campaign, and it's focused on sort of three key planks to it. The first is that if all or sufficient nations act simultaneously on these global issues, no nation need lose out. Okay, so the simultaneous implementation breaks this vicious circle of destructive global competition, as we call it. This nobody wants to move first problem. The second aspect is that we advocate a multi-issue policy platform. So what we're talking about is packages of multi-issue policy packages being implemented simultaneously by all or sufficient nations. Why multi-issue? Because if you take any single issue, like just carbon emissions, you will always have some nations that win, others that lose, and of course the losers have no incentive to cooperate, so nothing happens, right? Which is exactly the problem we have right now with the UN COP process, where the big emitters like the US, China, others, of course, have the most cuts to make, they have the highest costs to bear. There are no other issues to compensate for them, for that disadvantage, and therefore cooperation is almost impossible. So multi-issue policy packages are vital. The third and most important unique plank of SIMPL is that it's a way for citizens to use their votes in their national elections in a powerful way to drive governments towards global cooperation. So what does that mean? That means when you sign on to SIMPL, you agree to give strong preference at all future national elections to candidates or parties that have signed the pledge to implement SIMPL alongside other governments. Okay, so give strong voting preference to. That doesn't mean you give your vote to SIMPL. It means you're saying to politicians, I'm going to give very, very strong preference to politicians or parties that sign on to SIMPL. And, you know, in many, many elections, or, you know, in parliamentary seats or even entire elections these days, they're being won and lost on very small margins of people. And so, you know, if we can get this, and we've shown that this works. I mean, we have 100 members of parliament in the UK from all the main parties who've signed on. We have about 40 in Germany. We have about 14 in Ireland, some in Australia, some in the European Parliament. So we know that this process works. So I think, you know, we're at the stage now, I would say, where we've road tested the model. What we haven't yet managed to do is to get mass support for it, because, well, we can go into that. There are a lot of barriers that that we can explain why things are slow. So that in a nutshell is where we, you know, is that wasn't really an elevator, but it's a pretty tall building for an elevator.
I was going to say that was a skyscraper.
Anyway, that's it.
Yeah. So Jackie, maybe you can come in and talk about particularly the situation in the U.S. where I haven't heard about any Congress people running with the simple campaign, but maybe that's going on. So what's it looking like over here?
Well, I can say that you may not have, but it has not been because of lack of effort. it's tough in the United States in terms of politicians. Since I've been on board with Simpol, we've had a midterm election, and we've had the last full election, and we did manage to get some candidates signed on. Unfortunately, none of those candidates won in their constituencies, so we don't have anybody actually seated at this time. But we're making that effort, and that, you know, that's how it works. I mean, that's one of the things I do when you talk about, you know, boots on the ground. When a citizen signs up and supports Simpol, then we encourage them to write to their national, so their Senate's representative and their Congress representative, and ask them to take the Simpol pledge. And then we also do the same. So I write on their behalf to those two people as well and say, your citizen wants this. And I think the idea that John mentioned, that, you know, citizens are using their votes, I think that has encouraged some of the candidates. And I think I see that in which candidates sign up, because they are the ones that are usually in very tough races. So they're happy to, you know, maybe get those extra votes from Simpol supporters. But I would also say that we've had some great comments from some of those candidates in terms of their support of the whole idea. So I suppose that's one of my frustrations. You know, it's resonating. It's just not resonating in the big halls yet, being the, you know, the Senate or the Congress. But that's the challenge here. And also just the challenge, you know, right now I'm really looking for people to come and help in a team here, because it's not a one person job. So that's something we're really excited about, getting some more citizens that, you know, feel strongly enough about this to join in.
Yeah. Are you working at all at the level of states in the US, Jackie? I know, Ryan, you had a question about interstate compacts and how Simpol could be used at that level.
No, the Simpol does work at the national level. And that's perhaps in the United States a bit of an issue because of the size of the United States. But I mean, it's in somewhat it's a state representative, you know, if it's your congressman or your senator from your state, but we don't work in the state level of government. We only work at the national level of government. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the principle of Simpol and the voting lever could be applied to other national or local, state or even local issues. So, but we are only about the global level, and what we're really trying to you know, this is why I think it's Simpol's been slow to take off, is it because most people don't really understand the way the global economy works, so they don't understand why governments can't act. It's not that governments don't want to act on some of these issues like climate change, it's that they can't act on them because of the destructive global competition vicious circle. And I think that's also why we tend to get more support from politicians, not just because of the voting incentive, But because they have, like Jackie says, they actually genuinely, many of them genuinely think it's a really good idea. And that's because they are the ones who are most directly on the horns of the competitiveness dilemma. Citizens and NGOs who you would have hoped would be supporting us don't really get that, unfortunately, because they're not, that's beyond their sort of immediate knowledge, really. And so that's why it's slow.
I think sometimes it's like we're talking to people that are standing in water and they don't realize they're standing in water. And we have to point that out first before we can talk about, you know, the next step. And once people really understand that, you know, and how the destructive global competition is working, it starts to make sense. And, as John said, I think that's why the politicians resonate with it. I was just going to say, the other thing that I really like about Simple is that we're not trying to build a new structure. You know, there's a lot of other organizations out there that have great ideas, but it's about taking down what exists and rebuilding something different. And if you look at climate change, for instance, which is, you know, one of the issues, I don't think we have time for that. And so we're working with the structure that already exists and has some wonderful aspects to it, in terms of, you know, representation, and it just needs a different, you know, worldview perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually where Ken Wilber's and, you know, Spiral Dynamics was so important for me, because when I first came up with the idea for Simpol, I thought, oh, well, this is just so obvious. Everyone will get it, and, you know, we'll just get this going in no time. But it was only when I read Ken Wilber's work could I understand why a few people got it immediately, but most people just couldn't get their heads around it. And so I think the Spiral Dynamics is an important, you know, aspect of our work, or that the acknowledgement of those different levels of consciousness.
Right. That's why I say I think the key word is timing. And our current level of consciousness in terms of international relations thinks of everything basically in terms of space. This country wants this, and this country wants that, and they're separate geographically, and so they have different issues. But this timing, which is, you know, Jeremy Johnson is always about the aperspectival realm being a time-focused way of thinking. A mode of consciousness that is focused on time, that yes, you know, China wants this and the US wants that, but how much of that is due to the fact that we're not implementing it at the same time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other important thing about Simpol is the way it differentiates between national issues and global issues. So if we apply a test, we call it the subsidiarity test, to any policy proposal that somebody might make as part of Simpol, we apply a test. And the test is, would the unilateral implementation of that policy by a single nation or by a restricted group of nations be likely to cause that group or nation a significant competitive disadvantage? Yes or no? If the answer is no, it wouldn't cause a competitive disadvantage. It's a national policy. It means it's a policy that the nation or group can implement unilaterally without any significant impact on its competitiveness. That's got nothing to do with Simpol. If, on the other hand, the answer is yes, it would cause a competitive disadvantage, then it falls into the Simpol basket. And that's really important, I think, because that means from a national sovereignty point of view, Simpol protects national sovereignty, but it also enhances it by offering access to those policies that can only be dealt with cooperatively, right? So it's actually a win-win for national sovereignty. But if you, the problem today, I think, and as you were alluding to, Nate, is that all these things are just mixed up in one big pot. They're not differentiated. And that's why it's such chaos, you know? Because, of course, we don't yet have, well, I mean, apart from Simpol, we don't appear to have a global level governance tool. And therefore, by force of circumstance, everything is sort of jumbled up in this undifferentiated swamp. And, of course, it's a mess. And you know, So SimPol's the first thing. I mean, I keep an eye out for what else is out there. It's the only thing that I, because believe me, if I found something better, we'd give it up tomorrow. You know, it's the only thing I've seen that really teases apart those issues, has that subsidiarity criterion, has the multi-issue, the simultaneity, the multi-issue, and the voting incentive. You know, so it's really those things that are key, I think.
And that is the, I guess, the wonder of SimPol and the blessing, but it's also the complexity that makes it difficult to message sometimes.
Right.
Because there are so many pieces that need to fall for someone to really get the idea.
Right.
And, it seems, you know, sometimes when I talk to people, I can just see on their face that it seems like an enormous task. Like, that's too big. We can't do that. You know, I think one of my best responses was from someone who said, well, that would take an alien invasion. I think, well, I kind of think of climate change as an alien invasion, but it's just the idea that that's so large. And so then that leaves people feeling like, well, then where can I be part of this? Because I'm just a little person, and where can I be part of it? And then that's the next discussion, you know, where they can come in and where they can have an impact. And so it's a bit of a journey.
And it all comes down to this recognition of destructive global competition as being, in a sense, an alien, like an alien, in the sense that it's an emergent property of the global economy,
Timothy Morton, and he describes climate change as a hyper object, which he likens to something like an alien invasion. I think he says it's an invasion from the underworld, you know, it's a chthonic sort of feel to it, because it's huge and impersonal, and we can't do anything about it.
Right.
Well, that's right. But I mean, you know, what we're trying to say, and again, you know, everyone's in their silos, some on climate, some on this, some on that, but, you know, destructive global competition, this fear of the first mover, is actually common to all of these problems. So if we don't solve that, we won't solve any of them. You know, but it's a hard sell, like Jackie says. And, I think that as time goes on, the world is going to be hit by more and more and more of these global crises. And hopefully we'll be there ready with SimPol when people wake up, if it's not already too late for all of us, you know.
I think I want to comment on what Nate, you said about the hyper object. I think of destructive global competition and the planetary level multipolar trap, right? The game theoretic prisoner's dilemma that's occurring writ large that incentivizes defection and not cooperation or not mass coordination to be a kind of hyper object in and of itself, right? But the problem is that people don't really have the framework to be able to see the hyper object of destructive global competition as a phenomena. So one thing we really focus on meta-ideological politics is how we see the world and the frameworks that we're employing to illuminate hyper objects that we would have otherwise not seen. So I think part of the problem is just kind of a lack of literacy in things like game theory, where when I first read your book, John, it immediately resonated with me on an intuitive level, on a kind of emotional level, but I didn't totally understand it rationally in terms of the causal mechanics of how game theoretic traps occur. But when I started studying game theory, that's when I really became a huge fan of your work. It all made sense, but only after I was able to download the framework that enabled me to see what you're pointing to. So that's something we talk a lot about on this show, is political education and diversifying frameworks so that we can actually see the problems that you're pointing to.
Yeah, sorry, Jackie, go on.
I was just gonna say, there's a theory in education that you can't give somebody a new idea unless they have a track in their brain to take it in on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's called scaffolding, right? It's like, how do we convey this in a way that it aligns with what people already have as pre-established heuristics, and then they can bridge the new information with the old information. So I totally empathize with the frustration and not getting the message through, because people don't have that pre-established heuristic to understand what you're talking about.
No, that's right. And I mean, that was one reason I tried to involve myself with the integral community, about 10 or 12 years ago. And I wrote three different papers for the Journal of Integral Theory and Practice, after which Ken Wilber very kindly joined our advisory board, and he's been very supportive. But unfortunately, we haven't really managed to get much traction within the integral community, sadly, because I don't know, they just don't seem very politically minded. But I don't know. But I think the other sort of fascinating thing for me was being, you know, somebody actually said Simpol's the first thing he's ever seen that overcomes the prisoner's dilemma, which I thought was a nice thing for somebody to say. But we also got contacted by an evolutionary biologist, John Stewart, back in the year 2000, who pointed out that the way Simpol works is sort of mimics, in a sense, the way that evolution has overcome competition bottlenecks in the past. So if you look at the transformation of the protocell to the nucleated cell, or certain sort of key transitions like that, Simpol sort of mimics that, and that was important because I think it gave me the context, the broader evolutionary context that we're in now. You know, so you could say that human social units or human governance units have continuously expanded from families to tribes, to middle-aged small states, to nation states, and now we're in the game theoretical trap at the national, at the international level. And so the next step is some form of global cooperative governance, which is what Simpol is all about. So I think, you know, there's an evolutionary story to this. And I think that to me, that's important because I think one of the things that people need to, you know, as the water goes up around our necks, of course, if people don't understand this, they panic, you know. And what we're trying to say to them, look, guys, yes, this is scary, it's potentially suicidal, but it's part of a bigger story. And if we play our cards right, you know, this is the direction that evolution is telling us to go. And if we play our cards right, we can get there. So I think that's important too, yeah.
Going along with that, what I like about Simpol a lot is that it doesn't try to route around destructive competition, but it doesn't say that competition needs to go away.
Right.
Absolutely not.
And the issue that I think about in climate change specifically is the problem of CFCs that we faced 20 years ago or so that created the ozone hole. That issue has been solved. And I think there was a Vox video or something like that about how it was that got solved. And how it was that it was not any more expensive to switch to non-destructive chemicals in the aerosol. So everybody did it. So it wasn't a prisoner's dilemma, really. It was just something that we all had to fix. Whereas you're saying this, it's a mechanism design because the incentive structures toward competition are still there. We're changing the design of the game so that iteratively spontaneous cooperation will come about.
Well, yes, we're trying to design the framework for cooperation to give it the maximum chance of success. So right. Simultaneous implementation, multi-issue policy packages, citizen voting pressure, that gives it the maximum chance of success.
Hmm.
Never any guarantees in this game, but you know that's sort of what we're trying to do is to do that.
Right. So, like, to make it concrete, with the issue of climate change, the alternative to the Paris Agreement, which isn't working, is what, from the Simpol perspective?
Well, in our view, it would be something like an emissions agreement to cut emissions by 80%, whatever is necessary by a certain time on the one side, combined with a global tax raising policy. So it might be a currency transactions tax, or it might be a global wealth tax, or it might be increases in corporation tax. And those funds can then be used and apportioned to compensate the big losers on the climate part of the agreement. Okay, and in that way, hopefully, even the big losers today would say, well, okay, this is gonna cost us a fortune to reduce our emissions in the States, but we're getting all this tax revenue to pay for it. And so the idea is to make immediate cooperation and substantive cooperation in every nation's self-interest. Now, that's easier said than done, obviously, but it just seems to me completely logical that trying to deal with climate change on its own, we're on a hiding to nowhere. What are we on, COP26? How many more of these blasted things are we going to have? So we've got to bring two issues together where we have a tax raising issue to compensate a costly environmental issue so that the one can offset the other.
The other thing with Simple is that when people meet and are agreeing to these things, they already have the full support of their government. I mean, we have reached a majority in terms of supporting the structure within which these decisions are being made. So it's not like coming back from an international conference and then trying to get it passed in Senate. So you made a promise that doesn't get passed in Senate. So it doesn't matter what you said when you were there. It's not going to happen when you get back here. So in the Simple structure, that's taken care of before.
Yeah, providing we have the support. So if we have sufficient support. That means that there's an electoral cost to a government that doesn't enact what Simple supporters have required of them.
Right.
Because then they're going to lose those votes to their competitors probably the next time round. So there's an electoral incentive on politicians, and if we ever got to that stage, to make these agreements stick. The other point is that if cooperation is designed to be in every nation's self-interest, then so is the implementation of enforcement, verification, and enforcement measures, right? So if every nation sees the agreement as in its interest, they're going to agree, verification, enforcement, sanctions measures to make sure that the agreement, everyone upholds it. The problem right now is that these are like the Paris Agreement, is that they're actually not really in every nation's immediate interest, so nothing happens. They all clap themselves on the back at the end of the conference, but then the emissions keep going up. So we're trying to really close those loopholes in a sort of creative and constructive way.
I wanted to go back to the idea that I really love how you articulated, John, about having two categories or two different buckets to dump different policies into, right? So on one hand, you can think of policies that maybe could be enacted unilaterally, and then you have the simultaneous policy bucket. And I like to think about the first bucket more in terms of how we can experiment with catalyzing a race to the top where first mover action could be beneficial to the whole. So one example of something I think about is something that bothers me the most during, let's say, presidential campaigns is our debate system, where all these major media outlets host debates like Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. And each candidate, there's like 15 candidates on stage. Everyone gets 1 minute to talk. It all becomes sound bites and hashtag kind of no complexity, super unnuanced talking points that lead to the race to the bottom of the brainstem. And so people don't have a chance to get a more kind of holistic or nuanced, complex view of what that candidate believes or what they're about. And so what I would do if I was running for president is I would try to, as a first mover to overcome that, catalyze a race to the top of the neocortex by challenging every candidate to a 3-hour long form discussion where we can see how substantively you've thought through these issues and hopefully gain a competitive advantage doing that. That would then cause everyone else to do that. And then we strengthen our selection mechanisms as a society and as a democracy to elect candidates who are actually smart and thoughtful and can have a 3-hour substantive conversation on policy and other issues. So that's a way of directly countering the race to the bottom spiral by taking effective first mover action. So that's kind of how I think about the first category. Yeah, if that doesn't work, we dump into the other category.
What do you think TV race
would be like? How are you going to enforce that, Ryan? That's the question. How are you going to enforce that?
Well, the idea...
There was a law that said that all media election coverage has to be minimum 3 hours long.
Well, the idea would be I would get enough of a competitive advantage doing that. I would win over enough voters because they would want to see a long-form discussion. Kind of like with Joe Rogan's podcast, where now we have all these long proliferation of long form discussions. They could be really bad. You could have 3 hours of disinformation and bad stuff. But there's all that also kind of that podcast ecosystem emerged as a kind of counterweight to 5 minute CNN and Fox News appearances.
Yeah, and I think it would take a Joe Rogan to actually invite them all to host it. You know, it would take a Joe Rogan or a Jordan Peterson or somebody to actually initiate that that invitation. You know, they'd have to already have a big enough platform to do that.
I'm feeling just a little bit cynical listening to this. I'm thinking, really? Do you think there would be I was thinking about the TV ratings on that. Do you think there would be sufficient interest on something like that?
So my idea is, even if there wouldn't, I would use that to absolutely pummel my opponents for not having the balls to come and talk to me for 3 hours. I would use that as an attack and gain an advantage that way.
Damage your components or your opponents, yes.
But I would use it as a kind of blackmail tactic. But if it doesn't work, then we can consider simple options and media coordination options as a kind of way of thinking about resolve. And so I have thought about this in like a lot of other contexts. Another one would be at the national level, like addressing homelessness in cities, where cities are actually disincentivized from addressing homelessness because all the homeless people from all over the US would just go to that one city and they'd rather free ride off of other cities. So there was a big move, I think it was in Portland, where they were sending homeless people with one-way tickets to Hawaii, where I'm from. But if all the cities could coordinate and go all in together addressing homelessness, then that would offset the competitive disadvantage or first mover disadvantage of taking homelessness. So again, it's kind of like thinking like, okay, like you can experiment, and if everything I said doesn't work, it's nice that we have the simple bucket to then try it.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say to you, you know, about the 3 hour debates is the big problem is that all the candidates are pretty dumb, frankly, and therefore none of them will offer the chance to talk for 3 hours intelligently on anything, because I think that would be a bit of a struggle for them all. But I think, you know, one of the things I like to think that something like SimPol or these two buckets would help politicians, because when they are challenged on global issues, and there are more and more of them coming, they can say, well, look, for these issues, we support the SimPol campaign, and we call upon all other nations to do the same things so that we can deal with the issues. So protecting their national interest, but they're also inviting cooperation. And then on the unilateral national issues, they can be much more clear and decisive. This is something we can do if you elect us tomorrow. You know, the problem is at the moment is that politicians are promising that they can handle all of these issues, which of course they can't. And I think that serves to undermine people's confidence in politics, because we kind of know that they can't do any of this, you know, these global things. And a lot of them are actually affecting government's ability to act at the national level, because if they can't tax the rich or the corporations for fear of them going elsewhere, they're having to reduce their spending and to tax the poor and the middle classes who can't move elsewhere. And so their budgets are restricted, you know. So you know, destructive global competition is actually influencing governments' ability to deal even with national level problems.
There was an interesting comment made during COVID that I think it kind of speaks to this a little bit. They were talking about convincing people, using science to convince people to be vaccinated. And I heard this interview on NPR, and I can't remember who it was, and this person said, well, after a while, when you're trying to convince somebody of something, information is no longer of use. The only thing that's going to help is if they trust the person that's speaking. And if they trust the person who's speaking, then they're going to listen. But after a while, you just can't provide enough information to convince people of something that they should do. So I just thought, you know, that was such a wise comment. And where does that trust come from? And how, you know, where do we create those figures that people will trust? Mm. And those are rare politicians. They do come out there are politicians. When I'm originally from Canada. When I was there, I worked with the federal government. And one of the things I did was work with the politicians, and I met some that you could really trust. And there was definitely a difference. And there was a difference in how the communities that they worked in functioned. But it's rare.
That's a great point. I wanted to kind of seize on that because I was going to ask about other factors or other variables that need to be at play in order for a simple to work successfully. And I was thinking about trust in terms of the international relations component and how we can build trust and how important it is that we actually trust each other in negotiating these agreements in which a simple would enact, or in terms of actually going through with it and even wanting to participate in the process at all, right? Because if there's no trust, I'm very skeptical that the soft part of the negotiation would go very poorly. So I'm curious how you think about that and kind of the importance of good leadership to engender that trust.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's critical. I think the first thing to say is that cooperation tends to happen only when the water is right up to here. Okay, and that is an important element in the trust formula, if you like. And so, you know, I think this is another problem that we have in selling Simpol, is because people tend to judge it by today's standards or today's circumstances, where the water is pretty high, but people perceive it as being only down by their ankles. And so they think, oh, well, that'll never work.
But you somebody know, else is.
Well, yeah, exactly. but, you know, if people perceive the water as, you know, is really up to here, then cooperation is in everyone's self-interest at that point. And so I think you've got to bear that background in mind, that the final negotiations for Simpol would probably only take place, you know, at that point where, you know, the broad mass of governments really realize that it's either a global agreement or we're finished, you know. I mean, it doesn't have to wait to that stage if citizens would get with the program and we could drive this forward more quickly. But I think that's really one point. I think the other point, it comes back to what I said earlier about multi-issue policy packages. If you can make action in each nation's self-interest by having compensatory multi-issue packages, why shouldn't they trust each other? You know, it's in their interest, and they can implement as part of the agreement measures to ensure verification and enforcement and sanctions if anyone defects from the agreement. You know, so of course there are never any guarantees, but again, it's about giving it the best, you know, designing things in such a way that we give cooperation the best chance.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, our government, and I think we saw this, you know, with 9/11, and we saw it during COVID as well, they use fear as a tactic to get people to agree with what they need to do or want to do. And that fear destroys trust, you know, so it's actually working against itself.
Yeah, and I mean, also the whole process of signing on to Simpol is in a sense, whether it's citizens or politicians, it's saying, I'm ready to implement Simpol if you are, you know, I will if you will. And that is, if you can imagine that process sort of gradually becoming, you know, much more widespread, you know, that kind of flags people and politicians and governments as global cooperators, you know, so that also would contribute, I think, to the trust equation.
Right. There's two kinds of trusts. One is an imminent trust, that I know you, you're my friend, you're my brother, I trust you. It's that simple. The other is an abstract kind, which when it's done really well, mimics the imminent, but it doesn't work by the same dynamics. And the game theorist, Axelrod, I forget his first name, but he talks about a tit for tat a way to mimic trust, that it's slow, gradual, instances of low risk trust. And he talks about in World War I in the trenches on the Western Front, one side would shoot up into the air above the other's heads. And they're risking getting shot when they do that. But the other side remembers that they did that the next day. And maybe the next day they do it as well. And this, and historically, that led to the truce on Christmas, where they just stopped, and it was spontaneous. It was a spontaneous ordering, and they didn't know each other at all. They were on the other side of the field. Yeah, but that's what it mimics trust, and but that only happens in a situation where there is no end point, because if there's a set end point, as there is with the Paris Accord, where we say by this date we're all going to do it, everybody procrastinates until the very last day. Whereas if it's day by day, you set this agreement for today and we're all going to do it. If one side defects, that sucks, but we're not wasting 5 years of time. And so then we try again the next time and the next time and the next time. And spontaneously, that's how order arises, hopefully.
Yeah. No, that's right. And I think, that's correct. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's flipping the table, because it's we're making the imminent thing right now and the abstract thing in the future, as opposed to the imminent goal being in the future and abstractly, we're all going to work our way to get there. That's what I love about simple. Yeah. It's a flipping of the table. It's hard to put your finger down on what concretely is so different about it, because it's actually all the same logic or the same content, but the logic is flipped.
Now, Nate, now you give me an elevator. Let's see how long it takes you to do it, mate. It's not easy, is it? I mean, it's simple in one sense, but it's incredibly complex and beautiful in a sense, in another. We are where we are.
I'm wondering, since we have about 15 minutes left, I'm wondering if we can get into the Ukraine thing and maybe talk about how simple it could save the world from nuclear devastation writ large and the end of human civilization.
I wish.
Yeah. I mean, I think the I've been thinking about this obviously the last few days, and to me, I also saw a really interesting lecture by John J. Mearsheimer, who's a realist international relations academic, and he made the point that the liberal hegemony, as he calls it, which is the idea we very much have in the West that freedom and democracy is great and everyone should have it. And so he says there's this sort of proselytizing impulse behind liberal hegemony, this impulse to share democracy with everybody, right? And you can see that this, since the breakdown of the Berlin Wall coming down, and the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, the West, NATO and the European Union has sort of been going eastwards, sort of part of this process of sharing democracy with everybody else. But again, then here comes the spiral dynamic side of it. When orange green, you know, modern postmodern liberal hegemony hits red blue authoritarianism, it hits the buffers, right? And what that shows, I think, is that the liberal world order that we've been kind of presuming in the West for so many years is not adequate for the future. And we need to go to something like Simpol, I think, ultimately, which it treats each nation and each culture, it respects each one in its own context, so that there isn't this move impulse to parachute democracy into Iraq or into any other country. It's more a case of containing any dangerous, you know, red blue, but understanding that they're at a different level, and how can we encourage, you know, peaceful encouragement of their evolution rather than trying to sort of parachute it in or bring it in, you know, in a rather overt way. And so I think, you know, I mean, in simple, in my book, I call it simulculturalism. You might have seen that. Okay, so I think that simulculturalism is, you know, each nation and culture in its, you know, should be supported equitably in its own context through a global economy that is genuinely fair to everybody and underpinned by a global agreement that is, you know, simultaneously implemented. And I think that has a future, apart from it being a necessity for all the other reasons we've talked about. But I think, you know, so for me, this, you know, Simpal, of course, doesn't solve what's going on now. I think this is part of the process of the West realizing that however much we think democracy is great and that it is a higher value, unfortunately, you can't universalize it. And therefore, we need to find a different way. You know, so I think it's a wake-up call for us. And I think the this is again why, you know, the problem is that all of these international relations guys are going to be hunting around. Well, okay, well, we can see liberal hegemony doesn't work, but what do we replace it with? You know, and of course, none of them have any answers. Well, Simpal has a possible sort of outline answer, at least, I would say. You know, so, but we can't solve what's happening now. You know, at the end of the day, the West is going to have to man the ramparts of NATO, contain the threat, and hopefully not aggravate it.
Yeah, I guess to riff on what you were saying there, John, there's a lot of debate now on why Putin would do something that, from a rational perspective, looks incredibly foolish and certainly not worth the cost, right? And one theory that's been floated that I think is interesting to consider, I mean, God knows what's going on in Putin's head, but what's interesting to consider is that he's very threatened culturally by the ever-increasing encroachment of Western values and modern liberal ideals and postmodern memes and so forth on his own Russian citizens and Russian culture. And part of the kind of nationalistic, kind of retro-romantic Eurasian ideology that Putin goes by, that was architected by guys like Alexander Dugin, right, is very traditionalist and conservative and reactionary. And so it's kind of like a worldwide culture war in a sense. So he knew that all of the economic sanctions and so forth would hit Russia, and he'd have an excuse to then shut his whole country down, a la like North Korea, maybe to preserve the culture and with the fear that, you know, democracy and all of these Western liberal ideas will infect the kind of pristine, holy culture of Russia that he's trying to resuscitate.
Yeah. Well, that's right. But and when you sort of see some of the other, the shadow side of liberalism with all this sort of cancel culture and political correctness and fake news and storming of the Capitol,
realism, you know, and corporatism.
You can kind of see he's got a point, you know, in some senses. I think you're right. I think you're right. But again, I think that's also why, you know, something like Simpal eventually could be important, because Simpal is not an initiative that comes from any nation. It comes from citizens globally. You know, so I think one of the problems with the current international order is that any motivation for cooperation is sort of automatically tainted by the hidden hand of national self-interest of one party or another. Whereas Simpal is coming from a sort of neutral third position, which is really has everybody's interests ultimately at heart. I mean, I think certainly Simpal could contribute to the debate that is going to that we ought to be having. I think the sad thing is that we probably won't have it. We'll just man the ramparts and double down and do the same old things we've always been doing. I'm not sure it will work.
There's a natural human reaction to watching a bully, and that's how people will react, because right now they're watching a bully, you know, in the playground, and you just react. But I think the idea that, you know, at some point Simpal could be part of the discussion, just while you're talking, John, a couple of times it's come into my head, that's our challenge, because we have a framework that will work at some point. You know, whether it's when the water's up to here and everybody realizes it or whatever. And so our challenge right now is to keep that in the common thought, to make sure that it's known even if it's not completely adopted by people, but to keep it there as an alternative so that when it hits, when it's the right time, the option is, oh, well, what about that simple thing, you know, that they've been harping on about for 20 years. And that's really the challenge for us. How do we do that? And keep the campaign going when the actual action of it is probably not going to happen today.
Well, the way we keep it going, Jack, is by getting onto podcasts like this.
Yes, exactly. That was my point.
Well, as you said earlier, Jackie, it is, I think, basically an educational imperative, which works with the metaphor of the bully, too. How do you stop the bully on the playground? You can punch him back, and it's going to stop him right now. Everyone gains up on him, but he's still a bully. Whereas hopefully over the 12 years of his education, there's a scaffolding that happens that, you know, of course, it's maybe a little reductive to say that in the case of Russia, since they really do have national interests that are different. But it's creating the structure, the structure where hopefully 12 years, 20 years from now, people just think differently. And Putin looks out and sees the playground and he thinks, not worth it. Start throwing punches.
I mean, one of the things I've been doing recently is contacting universities, contacting professors of global governance, of politics, and introducing SimPoll to them. My logic being that if we got this into classrooms as an option, as an idea, I think it's a really good study point in terms of how this could work, what global cooperation could look like, what the structure of it could look like, and hoping that, you know, a few schools would adopt that as part of their learning, and also perhaps research, which would help SimPoll too.
It's a tough market in America, though, isn't it, Jackie? Because
I didn't have gray hair when I started.
As a Brit, you Americans, you automatically associate the word cooperation with harming your self-interest.
I won't take that as an insult because I was, you know, born in Ireland and grew up in Canada, but I am an American citizen, and I'm proud to say that.
Whereas competition is to be always your self-interest, and in a sense, we're sort of indicate that, you know, what in the right circumstances, cooperation can be in your self-interest, and that's really the point. You know, just trying to get that over.
Yeah, when I started with SimPoll, for me, it was a very emotional reaction. When I read an article in Economics, it was a completely emotional reaction. And these little figures here, these are not children standing still. These are life-size figures of my grandchildren. I have seven grandchildren. I just thought, how can I not be involved in something like this? And I thought that logic would work with everyone. Well, it hasn't, but I'm going to keep trying. And I think there's something to it. I mean, you said, Ryan, that you reacted emotionally to the SimPoll solution when you first read it. You know, so and that's kind of, you know, one of the strings you can start pulling people in, and then, you know, provide the whole information. But
I mean, if there's anybody, you know, you guys know in your circle who you think would be interested in this, please do put them in touch or you know, recommend, because, you know, I also think that there's a lot of people in our space who are wonderful, wonderful theorists. They talk beautifully and very articulately about all of these issues. But I sometimes think, you know, that we should be done with the theory now. We've got to move on to you've got to roll our sleeves up and get on with the dirty work of the practice. But we need people to come off the fence and look at SimPoll, think about it, help us to make it better, and get involved, you know.
And given the nature of the American culture, we need ambassadors or influencers, people that people will listen to, perhaps people that do trust for whatever reasons that can really share the message of SimPoll.
Well, consider us allies, and
thank you.
I mean, this is our whole ethos here at MIP too, is get into the trenches, you know, stop writing the Medium articles and whatnot, start sending emails, start making connections, start writing your congresspeople. It doesn't take as long to do. Yeah, run for office as well. you know, be the change.
Yeah.
So if you want to, how can people get in touch with you concretely? Do you have a
email address or something that we can link?
Yeah, there's on the US website, the Simpole website. There's contact there, and there's
So what is the US website, Jackie?
The US website is
us.simpole.org.
Yes, thank you.
And we'll link that too in the thing down there. So
Google it. Okay, no.
Cool. You should know how to Google too.
The global site. The global site is just simpole.org. Yeah.
But I'm always thrilled to hear from people if they have questions from the website or they just want to talk about it. You know, that contact information is there, and we'd love to have the discussion.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Yeah, well, thank you guys. Thank really you enjoyed it.
Awesome. All right. Stay safe.
Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.